RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Peter McCullough is an American cardiologist and former vice chief of internal medicine at Baylor University Medical Center. He's been involved in exploring and speaking out about alternative COVID-19 treatments and vaccines, which led to legal disputes and his separation from Baylor in 2021. McCullough is a respected figure in cardiology with notable academic and research contributions, though his stance on COVID-19 has been widely polarizing. For adopting an alternative viewpoint and challenging norms, Dr. McCullough's board certification by the American Board of Internal Medicine has been repeatedly attacked. We asked Dr. McCullough back to RCR to talk about the dangers of the US childhood vaccine schedule. Dr. Peter McCullough, great to have you on our radio station again. Thank you for coming on.
Great to be back.
What is vaccine scheduling? Can you tell us?
Well, I tell you what, it's such a tough word. In the United States, we use a hard K. We call it scheduling. But the rest of the world uses the soft CH, scheduling.
I was trained in BBC English.
There we go. What's happened over time since you and I were children is that the vaccines being administered have become part of a routine program where they're administered at time intervals, irrespective of any individual risks that patients may face, and independent of whether or not there really are any alternatives. And so what's happened over time, people have become frustrated with this, that diseases that are easily treated with an antibiotic, for instance, we still are giving vaccines for that aren't terribly effective. And of course, once the vaccines are injected, if there's a side effect, we can't get it out of the body.
So where did scheduling come from? Because it sounds like it's sort of like a one size fits all for everybody. How far does it go back? What's the history?
It goes back. The Center for Disease Control has a panel. It's called ACIP, A-C-I-P. And it's at least gone back several decades. Before, it was just pediatricians who worked with mothers. But as this schedule came in, people felt more implored to follow it. That is, that this was thought to be a good thing. Then in the United States, what happened is insurance companies picked up on this, and then they offered incentives to doctors' offices saying, listen, if you meet the schedule and, a certain percent that have accomplished this, then there are bonuses given out. On top of that, in the United States, the government came in and said, listen, if people don't have money to pay for these, the government will cover it. So the government broadly covers vaccination where they don't cover other forms of health care. So vaccines took on a special role in the United States. And I think it was really memorialized in 1986 with the Vaccine Injury Compensation Act legislation, which said, listen, vaccines have unavoidable harm. And so, therefore, the manufacturers are free of any liability. Before that time, there could be a lawsuit. In fact, companies were sued. One of the more dangerous ones was the cellular pertussis vaccine. And there were many lawsuits. And that ultimately, brought the companies to lobby to have indemnity. And they got it.
So it's sort of the perfect setup from that point on, it sounds like, anyway.
Well, if you're selling a product and everybody has to take it and it's on a schedule and there is no liability, if there's anything that goes wrong with your product, can you imagine if you're a company, would you rather make an antibiotic to treat a few cases of the problem? Or would you rather make the vaccine that has to be administered to the entire country? So the companies figured this out to, never take a vaccine off the schedule, just keep adding them. What made things worse in the United States, and I think many places all over the world, is that the vaccine schedule then became a requirement to go to school for children. You can see how this really started to amplify. And so parents now felt really obligated, even if there was a reaction. They figure, well, so we got to keep going with this because, my child needs to go to school.
Just hearing you say that, it really comes as no surprise then. The COVID phenomenon that we've been hit with, the genesis is in that, isn't it?
Actually, it goes back deeper. I think one of the best books is Dissolving Illusions by Suzanne Humphreys, a doctor. It goes back actually to the smallpox vaccine campaign in the 19th century. Back then, remember fluids back around 1850, they were draining lymph from horses and cows, sometimes even from a pustule from one person to another. They could not have been sterilized. They could not have. They didn't know if they even had the smallpox virus in this lymph serum, or it would be that in that case, it would be the cowpox virus. And they couldn't tell anybody if it was safe or effective. And in fact, people died with the smallpox vaccine. They transferred staph and strep and tetanus and syphilis. It was absolutely horrendous. This went on for decades. Parents were put in jail if their children didn't receive the smallpox vaccine. It led to an uprising in Canada and Toronto. There's famous pictures of all the parents on the streets. In the United Kingdom, it led to the Anti-Vaccination League. And finally, there was a formal legislation to say, listen, we can't require this. And as soon as the UK stopped requiring the smallpox vaccine, promptly 25% of the population stopped taking it. So the vaccines have this dirty history. When the first sets of polio vaccines came out, they were actually contaminated with polio. People actually contracted polio by taking the polio shots. I mean, these types of historical examples make us understand that, you know, when the COVID-19 vaccines rolled out, things were set up to effectively force them on the population.
How do we explain, and I'm going to ask you about what's been on the schedule and the growth of that schedule over the years, but how do we explain such an adherence to this, such a belief in it? It's so strong, isn't it? And I mean, a lot of us are questioning everything now. The buy-in's been phenomenal.
It's like a religious belief. It's what I call vaccine ideology. It's like a religion. And again, it goes back hundreds of years, probably back to Edward Jenner and the smallpox vaccine, where the concept here is mankind is inherently weak, but through the brilliance of science, we can make the human body more resilient, more robust through vaccination. But because the vaccines aren't perfect, in order for them to work, everybody has to take them. And if there's some casualties or side effects, they have to take it for the team. No one cares. And so this vaccine ideology, in a sense, is a medical religion. It's in a sense, mankind making God's creation stronger. And it applies not just to humans, but also to animals. You know, the vaccine schedule for pet dogs, for instance, has been on the same accelerating course.
What has the growth in the schedule been like over the years then? I take it that progressively vaccines are added as they come along. If we go back to the early days and compare it with now, how many vaccines are on that schedule now that particularly kids are exposed to?
Well, I can tell you I was born in the 60s, early 60s. I believe it was three shots and five different diseases covered. And now it's accelerated to dozens of disease covered. And if you include COVID, if it's given every 6 months, it could be 108 shots.
Wow.
And Paul, at one point during childhood, between ages one and two, there's over a dozen shots given at once. And I can tell you, if a baby gets sick, really sick with these shots and has a reaction and has a fever, children can actually develop a fever and actually have a seizure, because it's such so strong effect on the brain. And if there's a febrile seizure, there's a paper from Europe by Nielsen and colleagues that's concluded that there's about a 40% chance that child will develop a neuropsychiatric disorder like attention deficit disorder, autism spectrum disorder, Asperger's. So parents have come forward with their babies and said, listen, my child was fine. They were perfectly fine. They took a battery of shots. The next day, they developed a fever. And after that, they were never the same. In fact, there's very disturbing data published from the United States that 78% of sudden infant death syndrome, a healthy baby dying, occur within 1 week of one of these big batteries of shots, over 50% within 48 hours.
Are any of these vaccines necessary for children at all? If you're going to take a vaccine, at what point in life does it make sense?
There's five studies now showing that going natural, which is done in some cultures. You know, in the United States, we have a religious group called the Amish. They take no vaccines. That five studies showing taking no vaccines, children today are healthier, believe it or not. And there's lower rates of allergic diseases, asthma, allergic dermatitis, frequent throat and ear infections, lower rates of attention deficit disorder, Asperger's, autism spectrum disorder. They're actually healthier. And the theory here is that, you know, pumping the kids with vaccines for some is going to cause side effects and it's going to disrupt the immune system. Every healthy baby is given a hepatitis B vaccine on the first day of life. Hepatitis B is transmitted sexually and through use of needles for IV drug abusers. Healthy babies are given hepatitis B. And I tell you, the vaccine doesn't even last very long. And so I can tell you that because as an adult, I'm a doctor. I deal with blood and needles, and there's a risk I could get a needle stick injury. So, you know, I took the hepatitis B vaccine, you know, earlier in my career. A few years later, I checked the immunity. I didn't have any immunity. I had to take more boosters. So I can tell you, giving a child a hepatitis B vaccine today is a complete waste. It doesn't offer them any benefit and could offer them harm and some type of reaction. Now, if a baby is born to an active IV drug abusing mother with hepatitis B, the baby should get the vaccine because there could be vertical transmission. So what we're looking at with the vaccines, I think, is probably breaking up this schedule and doing it on a more of a risk basis. Again, healthy child needs nothing. But how about a child with severe lung disease like cystic fibrosis? Well, there, a diphtheria, tetanus, respiratory syncytial virus, pneumococcus, influenza, that could be a problem. Even though these vaccines are minimally effective, maybe a child with cystic fibrosis should take it. Healthcare worker later on, take a hepatitis B shot. So I think we could really reduce the intensity. All these vaccines appear to be far safer when they're given later in life, as opposed to giving during this neurodevelopmental period.
I think everybody anecdotally understands that autism has gone through the roof, to use a very non-technical term. And there'll be a reason for that, right? And are we in the territory here? Is there a link between this vaccine schedule, whatever the vaccines on that schedule might have some causative effect, and this explosion in autism? Because I remember when I was a kid, and I think we're probably similar age of era, and it was virtually unknown from memory anyway, back in the late 60s, early 70s.
Well, there were certainly not advanced detection methods now. You know, there's a lot more sensitization that this could be present in counselors and doctors and other people are aware. I finished today with an autistic young man. But when you and I were kids, it was 1 in 10,000. U.S. CDC today says 1 in 36. CDC and government agencies have no answer for what's causing it, no answer whatsoever. And I can tell you there's about 200 peer-reviewed papers in the literature showing that autism is probably related to a change in what's called neuromodulation of inflammatory factors that are incited by vaccination. And so this connection between excessive vaccination or multiple vaccination and autism is I think, worrisome enough that it should be fully investigated. And none of the government agencies are doing this. The pediatric societies aren't doing this. There's been a deep dive into what's in the vaccines, like mercury or aluminum. And I can tell you, I think it's more probable that it's related to just multiple vaccines being given together as opposed to any individual component. And so there's the great concern there. Now, you know, if there are older parents or with a sibling with autism, the next child is much more likely to get autism. So many parents decline vaccines in the next child. But as we sit here today with no other answer, you know, I think it's a reasonable scientific conclusion that indeed excessive hypervaccination could be the cause for the autism epidemic. And there should be an all hands on deck research approach to see if this is the case, because the vaccines, none of them are necessary. None of them are medically necessary or clinically indicated. And in today's world, we can always navigate. So let me give you an example. Pertussis and diphtheria, tetanus, easily treated with antibiotics. Children are at very low risk for adult pneumococcus, Haemophilus influenza B or influenza, so they really don't need those. Respiratory syncytial virus has been around for decades. We treat that with some nebulizers. We have advanced treatments in the hospital for severe cases. Polio is no longer in the water supply in Western civilization, so we essentially don't need to worry about that. You know, the polio problem went away with water sanitation, not the vaccine, very importantly. We don't have smallpox. In fact, the smallpox vaccine has been retired, but you and I got it. But smallpox was transmitted by bed sheets, a lot of these sores and using the same sheets and what have you. That went away with better hygiene. Measles, very mild. We haven't had a measles death in the United States in decades. And again, just, you know, good care with secondary antibiotics if needed. Mumps, not a fatal condition. Both, by the way, the measles and mumps vaccines don't work when there's outbreaks. People get them anyway. And now we're down to rubella. Rubella is an interesting one. Rubella is German measles. Little boys don't get it, so boys should never have gotten it. But girls, as they approach pregnancy, they can get congenital rubella syndrome. And so I think a girl approaching her years of reproductivity may consider the rubella vaccine, so they don't end up with this fetal syndrome. And honestly, as the kids get older, if they're in military barracks or going to be in close contact, whatever you, potentially the meningococcal vaccine makes sense. Later on, diabetics, I think, should get Haemophilus and pneumococcus and respiratory and influenza and adult RSV vaccines. There can be risk stratification, but far fewer vaccines given and stylized to the degree of protection. I've been a healthy person my whole life. And you know what? My mom kept taking me in. I actually pulled my vaccine card. And even though as a kid, I didn't get too many vaccines, later on when I added them up, Paul, you know what? I have 69 shots on my vaccine card, 69.
Wow. Okay.
Now, 40 of them were flu shots that I was forced to take to be on medical staff, be a doctor. And I've never had a single care or concern about influenza. Doctors don't spread influenza to patients. This is just excessive indoctrination. You know, I went to India and I took some more shots. I was afraid maybe I'd get something in the Indian rainforest. That was probably overkill. But I think the worst of all is I had mumps as a kid. And when I got my vaccine card from my mom, I said, "Mom, why did I get three more mumps shots even after I had mumps?" She goes, "Well, I don't know. I went into the doctor's office. They just gave you the shots." So what's happening is these additional shots are just given without any thought or consideration if the kids need them.
I'm just thinking of that term vaccine hesitancy. That seemed to be the real trigger for a lot of enforcement here. Mm-hmm. And in other countries, also persecution of doctors for spreading vaccine hesitancy. Listening to you, starting to make sense now. You can't have faith being lost in vaccines. Mm-hmm. Vaccine mm-hmm. hesitancy doesn't apply to one vaccine, does it? It applies to all of them in the end, right?
Right. So this idea, if it's a religion, don't lose faith. And even if there's a bad vaccine, we don't want that news to get out because people may lose their confidence in all the vaccines. Well, you know what happened, Paul? People did lose their confidence in all vaccines. And I have so many patients that come in the office, they tell me they're not taking another shot. Personally, Paul, I'm not taking another shot.
No, me either. So do you see that whole... the religiosity of it, do you see that starting to crumble now, Peter?
There's a small group of physicians now who've broken off. And you know what? They're being financially rewarded. For instance, in my area, there's a pediatrician. He says, "I don't believe in these shots. I'm not going to force them on the kids." He's overwhelmed with patients. Patients will pay a premium to see him. So you'll see the economics start to pan out. My office is full. I just can't possibly see everybody who wants to be seen. And so doctors are at a premium right now who are not going to force vaccines on their patients.
Can we trust at all any of the safety testing? Is there legitimate, credible safety testing? Or is that, I don't want to use the word scam, but is that part of the model as well? Safety testing that looks credible, but can it ever go all the way? Can it ever offer full assurance?
FDA says for traditional vaccines, about 2 years of observation is reasonable. For the genetic vaccines, 5 to 15 years of safety observation. But none of the vaccines have even come close to these standards. For the hepatitis B vaccine given to babies on the first day of life, there was only 5 days of follow-up. 5 days. And our U.S. FDA approved that years ago. So these have all had inadequate safety testing. And I'll tell you something else that's never been tested is the combined effect of giving 1, 2, or 3, or 12 shots at once. When you give 12 things at once, now you potentially amplify all kinds of actions and interactions. None of that's been studied.
And with mRNA, and we hear all sorts of stories now about multiple sort of endless production line of mRNA vaccines and the technology applied going forward. Now we're hearing about bird flu, all those things. There's a lot at stake, isn't there? So at what point does something give, do you think, Peter, or maybe it won't? What are your thoughts on that?
There appears to be no consideration for safety. It is a wild messenger RNA bonanza. A paper by Lalani and colleagues showed that, United States and governments all over the world, big companies have been investing in messenger RNA since 1985. Billions upon billions of dollars. There's a dream that we can give the genetic code for any protein in the human body and come up with all kinds of advances in human health. Basics about how long does a messenger RNA stay in the body? How does the body get rid of it? Where does it distribute in the body? What turns it on? What turns it off? All these fundamental molecular, biological, basic pieces of information are unknown. And the manufacturers, seeing billions of dollars go to Pfizer, Moderna, they see game on right now. So you have Sanofi, CureVac, BioNTech. These companies are making money hand over fist, and the regulatory agencies are not asking them for basic pharmacokinetics, pharmacodynamics, oncogenicity, teratogenicity, the standard safety profile that any drug would be required to produce is right now being omitted for messenger RNA.
Is that the revolving door effect kicking in there?
I think so. 9 out of 10 of the last FDA commissioners work for this biopharmaceutical complex, or they work for venture capital firms. Blockbuster drug after 20 years of development used to earn $1 billion in a year. Now Pfizer, Moderna earn tens of billions of dollars with no marketing or development costs. The money is flowing now for messenger RNA. And I can tell you, I'm looking at it. It doesn't look like it's a safe platform. I don't think there's going to be a single safe messenger RNA product.
Just before you go, because you're at the coalface in the surgery, dealing with patients, the first wave of adverse effects seems to have been cardiac, and we all know what they were. What are you seeing now? What are you seeing now?
Data have come forward and this comes from the Danish data, the Czech data, the vaccines have become safer. I think this is important. They're not as dangerous. The most dangerous shots were the initial ones in 2020 and 2021. That Moderna was the most dangerous. Second was Pfizer. Third was Janssen and AstraZeneca. And then fourth was Novavax. And then the Chinese vaccines after that. So at least we have a hierarchy. We've learned that. Sadly, the side effects are all due to the spike protein in the body. The vaccines all superload the body with spike protein. And the key thing is to have the patient prompt the doctor to measure antibodies against the spike protein, which is an available blood test That will give a proxy of how much vaccine spike protein is still in the body. I use this test every day in my practice. Patients need to prompt their doctors to do this. There are papers showing that the symptoms of long COVID and vaccine injury are directly related to antibodies to the spike protein. The antibodies aren't causing the problem. That's the body's response to it. It's the spike protein. And then importantly, we've made huge progress with spike protein detoxification. So McCullough protocol, base spike protein detoxification, nattokinase, bromelain, curcumin. You can get them over the counter online in New Zealand. Nattokinase, bromelain, and curcumin in combination, probably for a year or more, will help clear up the spike protein, gives us our best chance of resolving this whole problem of taking a COVID vaccine.
It's always good catching up with you, Dr. Peter McCullough. Thanks for coming back on again. And I'm sure we'll talk again at some point, and all the best to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Right now, free speech is under heavy attack in New Zealand and overseas, with governments constantly devising new ways to enforce censorship. To make sure you never miss the critical news and breaking stories you rely on, join the RCR mailing list today. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.